Iron Man 2, Tremors 3, Sharknado 6, and in 2020, they're coming out with a Fast and Furious 9. Now, if the box office has taught me anything, it is that people love sequels. Why is that? I think one of the reasons why we love sequels is because we want the chance to dive back into the story. We want to relive the magic of the original. We want to recapture the wonder. We want to relive the excitement. But if experience has taught me anything, it's that sequels are usually not very good. Very rarely do they recapture the magic of the original. Very rarely do they live up to our expectations. I mean, most of the time, they just let us down. For the past 4 years in our study of the Old Testament, we have been watching a series of bad sequels. Ever since the first Adam walked onto the scene and failed to trust God, failed to represent God, we've been looking for a new Adam. One who would succeed where the first one had failed. And one by one, each person that came onto the scene and stepped into that spot failed to live up to our expectations. Cain, what a disaster. Noah, naked and ashamed. One by one, we watched as each new Adam stepped up, and each time they let us down. Each time they failed to represent God, they failed to trust God. In chapter 3 of his gospel, Matthew introduced us to the next person to walk into that spot. Jesus goes up to the Jordan River to be baptized. And there, in front of John the Baptist, in front of his disciples, in front of the people that had been flocking out there, in front of the seeds of the serpent, those Pharisees and Sadducees that had also gone out, Jesus is identified by God as his son. This is him. This is the Psalm 2 nation-crushing King of Israel who will represent God. It is the Genesis 3 serpent-crushing ruler to replace Adam. Watch this one. Listen to this one. And now we're wondering, is this going to be another bad sequel? Is this one going to be able to live up to our expectations, or is this one going to let us down? Will he succeed where everyone else has failed? Or will it be another frustration along a long list of frustrations in the story of the Bible? Our story is going to pick up this week right after that baptism in Matthew chapter 4, if you want to turn there with me. In fact, if you'll allow me, I want to go back to verse 16 of chapter 3, and we're going to pick up right with his baptism and move right into chapter 4, because the story is continuous. This chapter division is completely arbitrary. So chapter 3, verse 16, if you'll pick it up with me. After being baptized, Jesus came up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened. And he saw the Spirit of God descending as a dove and lighting on him. And behold, a voice out of the heavens said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, then he became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." But he answered and said, "It is written, 'Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God.'" Jesus is baptized. He is declared to be God's Son. The Spirit of God descends upon him, and the first thing it does is leads him into the wilderness where God is. No, not where God is. It leads him into the wilderness where the devil is. In chapter 3, as we previously mentioned, we saw the seeds of the serpent hanging around, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Well, where there's smoke, there is fire. Where you have little serpent babies, you know that there is a big serpent hanging around. And we're introduced to him here, the devil. And the question that I ask when I come to this is, why would God lead Jesus, his son, into the wilderness? And the text says, of course, to be tempted by the devil. Now that's par for the course for the old serpent. That's plan A, if you remember the story. Genesis 3, the first thing he tries to do, I'm going to deceive God's representatives. If he fails to deceive, there's always plan B. He'll just go out and kill them himself. But his primary plan, plan A, is to deceive God's son, to deceive God's kids, his representatives. That's par for the course for Satan. But that sounds like a strange thing for God to do. To which I ask, why is he sending his son out into the wilderness to be tempted to sin? Could Jesus be tempted to sin? C.S. Lewis once said, "A silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later." That's why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They've lived a sheltered life by always giving in. Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows the full extent of what temptation means. He is the only complete realist. I gotta admit, I really like how that sounds. And there is truth in that. I'm just not sure if that last part is entirely accurate. Could Christ be tempted to sin? I mean, I'm not asking if the devil was tempting him. Certainly the devil is the tempter. He comes to tempt. What I'm asking is, could Christ be tempted? Was there an internal desire within Christ to do something that may have been contrary to that of the Father? That's the question. Now, I think that our focus on Matthew chapter 4 as the temptation of Christ has somewhat blurred our focus on what Matthew is doing in this chapter, of how this particular scene contributes to the narrative in this story that Matthew is telling. First, let's deal with the text. Now, the word here you find that is translated tempted in the Greek has an elasticity of meaning. It has a range of meaning. It can certainly mean tempted in the way that we think of this word. It can also mean, and is translated as, tested. Tempted, tested. So James, in the first chapter of James, will say, "Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials," tests. That's our word. But later on, he's going to say, just a few verses, this is the same chapter, "Let no one say when he is tempted," there's our word again, "I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust." Same word, so we see that it can be employed in a variety of ways. It can be employed to refer to the lust of our sinful hearts. That thing inside me that comes out when I'm put in a position to acquire something that I desire. The object of my affection. Maybe if it's in jeopardy, you know, I'm saying, I'm going to have to come out and get it. Or maybe someone comes along like a tempter and says, "Hey, I might not normally have gone after that thing, but when it's presented before me, this working inside my heart comes out." And I say, "Yes, I do want that. I can use it that way, as the lust of my sinful heart, or it can refer to being placed in a situation to reveal something, to demonstrate the quality of something. So you test a precious metal, gold, to find out the purity of the gold. Really, you are, it's not even a question. You can be revealing something through the test. You can be demonstrating something to be true by putting it to the test so that it will succeed. So I recognize it can be used this way, it can be used that way, and of course, it is context that's going to have to tell us. Just like in normal everyday discourse, words have a range of meaning. I know what the words mean because of how they're employed, how they're used. So the question is, how is it going to be used in that passage? Is it used that Jesus has gone into the wilderness so that that which is within Him can be drawn out of Him? That temptation that He has? Or is it used, is He being placed in a situation so that what is in Him or about Him can be revealed? I think Matthew wants us to look at this passage with the latter definition. And I think that will become more clear as we go through this. The question that I want to ask today, I'm sure you've all looked many times at this and heard many sermons talking about the temptation of Christ. Today I just want you to look at it as a scene in the story and ask the question, what does this situation reveal about Jesus? We'll still ask the question, could Jesus be tempted to sin? But I think that it should be framed in, what is this scene revealing about the answer to that question? What does this scene reveal about Jesus? God, the Spirit, leads Jesus into the wilderness. I've been to the wilderness in Israel. Nothing's there. I mean, it is a rough terrain. It is mountainous. It is hot. It is windy. It is barren. It's not somewhere that you would want to stay for a weekend. Not if you had a choice, but it's the place that God sent Jesus to stay, we find, for over a month, and He is without food. He sends Him to a waste place that has no food, and Jesus is fasting. He's fasting, and it says that after 40 days, Jesus becomes hungry. Now, I'd wager dimes to dollars that Jesus was hungry before that 40 days was ended. 40 days is a long time to go without food and water. But the point that Matthew is making is that this encounter he's having with the great tempter comes at the end of this 40. He's already been out there for 40 days like this. Jesus is going to be hungry. He's going to be physically weak. The old serpent is coming to Him in His bodily weakness to make His first attack. You know, I think of the ad campaign that Snickers ran. I don't know if they're still running it. You know, you're not yourself when you're hungry. So I think of the one with the college guys out there playing football, and a guy passes the ball, and as the camera pans, there's Betty White, and Betty White catches it, and then she just gets laid out, and they huddle up, and the guy says, "Brad, you're playing like Betty White out there. You know, give him a Snickers. You're not yourself when you're hungry." Or I think of the guys in a car traveling, and Aretha Franklin's in the back, and she's just whining. They're saying, "Jimmy, you're being a diva." "I'm not being a diva. Here, eat a Snickers. You're not yourself when you're hungry." Is that true? That we aren't ourselves when we're hungry? Judah changes a lot when he's hungry, I'll tell you that. Is that true? Do we become somebody else? It may seem like that, but I think we know that the truth is, that's you. That irritated, snappy drama queen is you when you don't have the resources to put on a show. You know, when you've been pressed to your limit and you don't have the patience to show patience anymore, to put up that veneer, that's you. And that's where Satan, that's the way that Satan is couching his attack. Let's pull off all the veneers, all the fancy boards on the outside, and see what's on the inside. I'm coming to Jesus when He's hungry, when He's tired, when there's no way He can put on a show. That's when He's going to make His attack. And this is what His temptation sounds like. Sounds like this. If you can, then you should. If you can, then you should. Satan's not asking Jesus to perform a random display of his deity. He's not saying, do a miracle, prove that you're the Son of God. That's not what he's interested in here. He's telling Jesus, look, if you're the Son of God, you better make sure that you don't perish here in the wasteland. God apparently isn't taking care of his kids. Look, you don't look like you've had a meal in a month. I mean, you are skin and bones. Have you seen yourself, Jesus? No, because there's no water out here. There's no reflection. I know you haven't, but you look hungry. 2,000 years from now, let me tell you, there's going to be a thing called child protective services. And if they saw how God was treating his son, they would take you away from him. You need to eat. God helps those that help themselves. And right now, if you want to make it through this thing to be the Son of God, to redeem Israel, to restore the nation, you better make yourself a snack. Why don't you take one of these pebbles and turn it into a little piece of bread? Make some pita bread out of pebbles. That's the temptation. In response, though, we notice in verse 4, Jesus answers and says, it is written that man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Is that a real response? Or is that just a pious platitude? How in the world does that answer Satan's challenge? To find out, we're going to have to look at what Jesus is quoting. Jesus is going to the law. He says, I got an answer for you. It comes from Deuteronomy. It is written. And it comes from Deuteronomy chapter 8. I'm going to read it for you. You can turn there with me if you like. Deuteronomy chapter 8. And I'm going to start in verse 2. This is what it says. Deuteronomy 8, 2. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Why would God lead Jesus, his son, into the wilderness? Why would God lead Israel, his son, into the wilderness? We find here that God led Israel into the wilderness to test them, to reveal what was in their heart. God led Jesus into the wilderness to test him, to reveal what was in his heart. And the question on the table is this: does Jesus trust God? That's the question. Adam, God's son, did not trust God. Israel, God's son, did not trust God. Will Jesus, God's son, trust God? The whole reason, according to Deuteronomy 8, that Israel is in the wilderness is because they had to learn to trust God. They have to understand He is your life. It's not in cheeseburgers and French fries. It is God. He's your life. Jesus, God's son, trusts God. To which the old serpent in Matthew 4 says, aha, okay, but is God trustworthy? You trust God. Okay, clap for you. Very good. Is he trustworthy though? Pick up our story in verse 5. Matthew 4, verse 5. Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, He will command His angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. And Jesus said to him, Again, it is written, You shall not put the Lord your God to the test. Satan's next temptation sounds like this. If God can, then He should. He says, okay, look, you've read the Old Testament. Great, Jesus. I've read the Old Testament too. And it says in Psalm 91 that God's going to take special care to protect His Messiah. He's going to even assign babysitters for you to make sure that you don't hurt yourself. So since you trust God, why don't you demonstrate that God is actually trustworthy? I mean, if you think that God is with you, let's do a trust fall and see if He catches you. Just fall right on back and let's see what happens, Jesus. He said He would protect you, so He has to protect you, right? In fact, He needs you. It's not like He can redeem Israel without you if you are the Son of God. It's not like He can rule the nations without you if you are the Son of God. It's not like He can remove the curse from the earth without you if you are the Son of God. If you are the Son of God, then God has to act. Now notice again in our text, Jesus responds by appealing to Deuteronomy. This time it's Deuteronomy 6:16. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And once again I ask, well, how in the world does that answer Satan's challenge? And to discover that, this time I'd like to look at the event that Jesus is referring to. We find it in Exodus 17. Exodus 17, and I'm just going to read the first seven verses for you. You can follow me if you like. Exodus 17, verse 1. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, Give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water. And they grumbled against Moses and said, Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, What shall I do with this people? A little more and they will stone me. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, because they tested the Lord, saying, Is the Lord among us or not? The Lord had just led Israel out of Egypt. The Lord had just struck down the nation of Egypt with a series of incredible plagues. The Lord has just judged Pharaoh and Pharaoh's army with the Red Sea. He's been going for the camp of Israel by day in a cloud, by night in a pillar of fire. And they want to know if God is with them or not. Oh, and by the way that they can tell if God is with them is if He fulfills the things that they want. If He does the things that they want Him to do or not. That's how we'll know. If He does this, then we'll know He's with us. Not by these miraculous signs of deliverance. Not by the fact that He is literally manifesting His presence. It's if He does the things we want. You know, they made God basically into a genie of the lamp that grants their wishes. That's how we'll know that He's our God. If He does what we tell Him to do, then we know we can trust Him. This is a mistake that Israel made, if you recall, repeatedly in the Old Testament. They thought that they could force God's hand. They did things like bring the Ark of God to battle so that they could force God to fight for them. And He did fight in those battles, but they found He didn't fight the way they thought He would fight. He whooped both sides. Whenever in Jeremiah's day, Jeremiah was trying to tell the people, look, y'all got to repent, or in fact, no, just pack your bags because we're going into exile. Get ready. And the false prophets are there saying, ain't no way that we're going to get trounced over here in Jerusalem. Why? Because Jerusalem is God's city. It's the city of the King. It's the city of the Messiah. It's the city where the temple is and God's presence. Ain't no way that God is going to destroy Jerusalem, His own city. And then He did. They said, well, He said that He's going to rule from here. Therefore, He can't destroy it. Oh, He can. He most certainly can. You cannot make God do anything. That is what it means to be the boss. The boss tells you what to do. He is sovereign, no one above Him. You cannot manipulate Him. Those of you guys who might be familiar with Kenneth Copeland, Benny Hinn, you might know that they are part of the Word of Faith movement. And the Word of Faith movement teaches the force of faith, that you can create your own fortune by believing it and speaking it. That by speaking it into existence, there are certain faith laws to which even God operates so that you can manipulate God to create and manifest for yourself wealth and health and prosperity. If you step out on faith, God will work. Is that true? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Time and time again in the story, if we watch the Old Testament story, He will tell His people, you've made a mistake. You thought I made that promise to you. Ahaz, I made a promise to David. Well, I don't see your name in 2 Samuel 7. When John the Baptist is out there, you remember, and he's telling Israel, you guys need to repent. You need to put on God's jersey. You need to get on God's team. Don't you dare say we are children of Abraham. I don't see your name in Genesis 12. God makes a promise to Abraham. But if you're not following in the faith of Abraham, you're not going to participate in that promise. He didn't make a promise to you. If you want to go and take a leap of faith to try to force God to catch you, you better get ready for a rude awakening. He does not have to. You cannot force God. He's the boss. Jesus says, in this particular instance, well, that's a nice try, Satan. But you don't use a piano to test a tuning fork. It's not God's job to conform to your character, Satan, to prove that He is faithful. God is the standard. We conform to Him. We don't put God to the test. He puts us to the test. He is the standard. That's what we're reaching for. Perfection. To which the old serpent says, but it doesn't have to be that way. Jesus, it doesn't have to be that way. Notice it. Verse 8. Again, the devil took Him to a very high mountain and showed Him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to Him, all these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship Me. Then Jesus said to him, go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve Him only. And the devil left him. And behold, angels came and began to minister to him. Jesus is the Son of God. This is a title, and with this title comes certain expectations for this person. It is a character that will fulfill a particular role. So I ask, what does the Son of God do in the story? What place does He play? What part does He play in this great story we've been watching? What's His role? According to Psalm 2, his role is to ask God, and God will give him the nations as his inheritance.
so that he will rule all the nations. Now, are the nations going to accept his rule? Well, that's the challenge at the end of Psalm 2, is you guys really need to accept his rule before it's too late. Because at the beginning of Psalm 2, the nations are actually in an uproar. They don't want God's chains on them. They want to tear his chains off. They want to say, you're not the boss. You don't get to pick it. And God says, well, that is hilarious. In fact, my son over here, that's the one that's going to rule. Son, kill them all. So at the end, the psalmist is saying, guys, you need to get on board before it's too late. But the problem is right now, these nations are on Satan's team. They are not on board. They follow Satan's thought patterns. They follow his philosophy, saying, God, that's not the way that it has to be. We can rule ourselves. There's another way other than your desires, your order for this world that you have created. A better way, our way, what's right in our eyes. We got a plan. Now, since these belong to Satan, Satan approaches Jesus and his last temptation sounds like this. I can, so you should. I can, so you should. He's saying, look, there doesn't have to be any enmity between us. There's no need for any head bruising or any heel bruising. We can leave all that behind us, Jesus. That's God's deal. That's not our deal. There does not have to be hostility between me and my people and you and your people. This is simple. You want the nations. I own the nations. I can just give them to you right now. You don't have to go through with the cross. We don't have to go into battle. I'll just give them to you. And I'm happy to do that. All I want in return is your worship. All I want in return is your affection. And after all, isn't it right for the Son to worship the one who gives him the nations? Isn't that how Psalm 2 goes? You get the nations, he gets worship. He doesn't own the nations, I own the nations. So how about it? And for the third and the final times, Jesus responds, it is written. And he quotes Deuteronomy. Why? Why is he quoting Deuteronomy to respond to the temptations of the serpent? Because Jesus is the character of God in a man. And because Deuteronomy, the law, is the revelation of the character of God in His Word. So the reason the law is there is so that when Jesus comes on the scene, we can identify Him. Because we look at Him, we watch His works, and we listen to His words, and it sounds just like that. That thing we've been watching this whole time, and Israel's been beaten up side the head all the way through the Old Testament because they can't seem to get with it. And everybody that walks on the scene seems to have their own idea how this thing ought to be run. And it doesn't go with Deuteronomy. You know, Solomon walks on the scene and says, all right, as a king, you don't multiply. You don't get these foreign wives and multiply them. You don't get horses. You don't amass riches. He says, nah, I'm going to do that. Jesus comes on the scene and we hold them side by side and they're the same. He is the character of God in a man. He is the law of God in a man. And now that plan A has failed, well, the old serpent leaves. Why? Because he's got plan B to work on. We got a story still to finish. Kill the kid. Kill the woman, kill the kid. Because God's plan at the end of this story is going to have both the nation of Israel and their king. If he wipes that out, he wins. So we come back to our question, which we posed at the beginning of our text today. What does Matthew 4 reveal about Jesus? Could he be tempted? No. The point of the testing in Matthew 4 is to reveal what was in Jesus. What is in Jesus? The law is in Jesus. That he could not be tempted. He is that perfect one who came, who perfectly represents God, who is without sin, who can act as a substitute and rule in righteousness and justice. So what about us? It's not about us. See, Matthew did not write this so that you and I would know that when the devil shows up, Deuteronomy is his kryptonite. That's not the point. He didn't write this to tell us how to resist the devil. He wrote this to tell us who resisted the devil. I mean, if the devil shows up, you're done. Why? Because you're not Jesus. Can you walk on water? Can you turn stones into bread? What makes us think resisting the devil would be any easier than those things? If we can't do those things already, then there's really nothing in the book of Matthew to help us get there. That's not what Matthew's doing here. He's not trying to tell us how to copy the acts of Jesus. It's not about the how, it's about the who. We've read the Old Testament, Adam after Adam, sequel after sequel, time after time, the serpent wins. And his record is incredible. But it is not flawless. And Matthew writes to tell you about the one who was tested and succeeded where everyone else has failed. He's the one who didn't let us down then, and the one who therefore will not let us down now. He is the last Adam. He is the King of Israel. He is the law of God living in a man, and his name is Jesus. Jesus.